our next case, which is case number 60949, the People's Legislature versus Ross Miller in his official capacity as Secretary of State, and other respondents as well. Mr. Waters, you may proceed on behalf of the appellants.
I'd like to save about 7.5 minutes for the
Very well. We'll sound just so everybody knows, you need to stop talking, and at that point in time, reserve the time. If you go on, it continues to exhaust the time.
And I would like to hand out copies of the statute to show the headings on some of
them. Have you shown them to the respondents?
Chance because it was...
Why don't you take a moment?
It moved faster than I thought you would. There's a copy of the statute. And then our repeal, and I wanted the court to have it.
If there's no objection, it's just a copy of the statute. Is anybody, Mr. Benson, anybody in your group have any objection to this?
I have a slight objection, Your Honor. It looks like the first chapter is 241, which, if I'm not mistaken, is not in any form of the bill in this case.
It was referred to as one of the changes in 224, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, why don't we do this, Mr. Waters? You can go ahead and distribute it. We'll lay it for what it's worth here. We'll just use it as a reference here, and anybody's welcome to comment. You may just pass it out to the justices.
Thank you.
Okay.
The purpose of the handout for this was...
Okay, why don't we go ahead and get started. We'll call the case, and Tracy can commence the clock. Mr. Waters, you may proceed.
And just generally speaking, back up a little bit. This case, I believe this case, a first impression of the intervening all deny this, but what this is a case of public policy, purely public policy, on state issues only, no federal issues. They've been separated by the federal court. It's strictly a case of public policy of whether or not this court is going to decide to have a different standard for the people's amnesty versus a different standard for the legislature on the single subject matter.
And I think we would realize that. Maybe you could talk about standing of the appellants.
Let's start with the standing. Are we talking about standing for AB 81? First of all, as to 81, the amendments that took place, they changed that Senate vote 10% about three times and got knocked down in the court, like by the federal courts, about three times. In 2009, they made it applicable to the congressional districts, and that got upheld. Okay? But then when they amended the 211, all of them got merged in it. So it's the 211 one that they would be enforcing on us if we had a amnesty petition. So I think, since it all has been emerged, we have a standing to challenge this. Now, if you're talking about the declaratory judgment standing or the fact that we didn't file it, if that's the standing that this court's talking about, that's different. First of all, the Declaratory Judgment Act covers specifically in 3030 and 3040 of NRS challenges to statutes. That's expressly set on it. Then 3070 says even if we don't mention it, other things the court can take and make a declaratory judgment on. The second reason is the 224 does not exempt or does not prohibit a declaratory judgment action. And the reason we filed a declaratory judgment action, Judge Gibbons, is because if we file it with the Secretary of State, we'll get sued by all of the power brokers in this state and we'll run us out of time. Article 19 gives us 237 days to get signatures. If we don't do this, we'll be running out of time, which is the typical tactics in these type cases.
But without submitting it to the Secretary of State first, doesn't that make it essentially an advisory opinion by us?
Well, let me ask you this, Judge Paglia. If we file it with the Secretary of State, we're locked in the procedures and the clock's running. Right now, the clock's not running. We have our 247 days if we file it, if we're allowed to file it with this court. But if we file it, the clock's running. That runs us out of time like they always do.
Mr. Waters, yes. I have a question, which is why wouldn't the personhood Nevada case require us, however sympathetic we might be to your argument, to say you don't have a petition on this ballot, you didn't file it, any claim of injury is speculative. Why doesn't that case address what we're arguing in a very negative way for you?
Well, if I understand your question, say, how are we injured right here? Because they'll sue us the minute we file it. The minute we file the secretary, we will be sued. And the court knows that 208 and 210, they all got taken off the ballot because they get sued for not only single subject, but for the 200-word description of fact. And if they change one word, all of your signatures are gone. Now,
so your argument is that even though the specific initiative hasn't been filed, the organization's intent to file an initiative is chilled.
Yes, Your Honor.
By the uncertainty associated with the enforcement of the statutory single subject statute.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I believe that gives us standing. See, standing is always important in these cases. That's why they're crying about the legislature. There's opened up a whole bunch of problems with the legislature. Rarely do you have standing to challenge a legislative act. It's pretty rare that you do that. In this case, we have standing.
Let me just return to my question. It's a follow-up. The person in the decision says, as for appellant's plans to file a similar initiative petition in 2012, addressing the potential future initiative at this point is speculative and lead to an improper advisory opinion. Now, personhood was an appeal of an injunction, so perhaps that would distinguish it from this case, but I'm not satisfied that this case doesn't stand as precedent for what we have to do here.
Well, technically, I guess I'm a little bit confused. We have a exhibit to the complaint is a copy of the initiative that we intend to file without any changes, unless this court makes it. In any other initiative, we invite this court to make changes that they think violates public policy of the federal constitution. We invite that. I've never seen that before. But this invite. So we're in final form. We'll change not one word. If this court approves it, we'll go ahead and file it. Unless this court makes some change, no change will be included in it. Now, I don't know how much rapper we can be than that.
Okay.
I don't know if that answers your question.
I see your point.
Mr. Weiserson, if Justice Pickering's question has been answered, I know we have some other issues here, and we wanted to get your feeling on that. Can maybe I can jump to them in some of the ones I think it may be a concern to the court. As far as the issue of the single subject rule, we have the statute as far as initiatives. We have the Constitution as far as legislative actions. Is there any difference because the legislative rules are in the Constitution versus the statute governing initiatives? Does that have any play as far as you're concerned?
Slight difference. They try to make them germane to each other in the statute, whereas in the Constitution it doesn't expressly say they have to be germane to each other. It leaves it a little bit vague, but it's essentially the same rules. But it's been vigorously enforced on the citizens' initiative and just completely not enforced for the legislature. Now, the cases they cite are not near as what I call awesome is the ones in this case, because the title alone is 247 words, just the title alone in 224. And we have an affidavit from an English professor, but that's not important, but he says it's got several subjects in it. I know it's a judicial question, but at least that's...
So basically, to sum it up, if the legislation propounded by the state legislature and initiatives propounded by the people should be treated the same way as far as the rules on the single subject.
To do. And the strict, I'd rather the strict one be applied to the legislature because that would make them more transparent.
Okay.
One way or the other.
Would you like to preserve the balance of your time?
I thought that's what it was for.
It is. Okay. Thank you. So, okay, Mr. Benson, we'll start with you and we'll try and jockey this up so we can get up and speak.
Please support Deputy Attorney General Kevin Benson on behalf of Respondent Russ Miller. I'm going to try to talk for about 7.5 minutes and then turn it over to counsel for the interveners. First of all, with regard to this case, the claims in this case are that these two bills, AB 81 and SB 224, are unconstitutional under the legislative single subject rule, under Article 4, Section 17. But as I understand the appellant's argument this far, they're really not arguing that those bills are unconstitutional under this court's existing precedent of that constitutional provision. This is not a case of first impression. The liberal application application of Section 17 is very well established and has been for many years. Even back in 1907, this court said that it's so well established it's not worth going through all the case law to discuss it. So what they're really asking this court to do is to apply a new rule, a new interpretation of Section 17. And so I'm not even going to address whether these bills are constitutional under existing standard because I think it's quite clear that they are. Instead, I'm going to jump right to their main argument, which is that the court should adopt a new rule. And there's lots of reasons why this court should not adopt that new rule. But I'm only going to try and touch on a couple of them here. The first one is simply stare decisis. And then I want to get into the difference between direct democracy and representative democracy and the distinction between these two processes. And then I'll get to the standing, particularly on AB 81, if I have time to get there as well. But quickly on stare decisis, as this court has recently stated in Miller versus Burke and Child versus Lomax, the precedents of this court are not overturned except for compelling reasons. And it is the challenger that bears the burden of showing those compelling reasons. Particularly, they have to show that the prior precedent is clearly erroneous and that it has worked a serious detriment to the public interest. In this case, they have not met that standard. Even if you take everything that they say as true about how difficult it is to run an initiative petition in Nevada, that does not meet the standard because what we're talking about here is a constitutional rule that applies to legislation across the board. It applies to how legislation is enacted, not the substance of that legislation. So to the extent that they talk about being harmed because they feel that they are chilled because they can't run an initiative petition, that is a distinct effect that they are alleging from these particular statutes, not from the application, the liberal application of Section 17. And furthermore, by the way, that is essentially a First Amendment chilling effect, which is in front of the federal court and is not here in front of this court. And furthermore, this court, this has been the interpretation for at least the last 120 years, possibly longer than that. In my research, and I don't recall seeing any cases cited from the opponents, no state has adopted a rule as strict as they are proposing this court adopt, in this case for their constitutional single subject rules. Every state that has a similar rule in their constitution has applied that very liberally. So there's simply no reason to change the rule in this case. And furthermore, getting into the substance of the difference between direct democracy and representative democracy, the rules are different for a reason. Other than the ultimate result of creating new law, the two processes have almost nothing else in common. And so it naturally follows that there are different rules to govern those different processes. And this is discussed fairly extensively in the briefs, but I wanted to direct the court's attention particularly to the Fine versus Firestone case out of Florida, because it's remarkably similar in many respects to this case. And in that case, the Supreme Court of Florida explicitly retreated from the notion that the two rules are or ought to be the same. And it did that for a couple of reasons. First, it pointed out the textual differences between its initiative rule and its legislative rule. And as I discussed in the briefs, the textual differences in Nevada are actually even more pronounced than I think they were in the Florida case. But then I think more importantly, the court discussed the differences in processes. And they pointed out, for example, in the legislative process, there are considerable more safeguards built in. You have bicameralism, you have presentment to both the houses, you have these public hearings that take place on the bills. You have the opportunity for compromise among the legislators, for amending the bill, for making it better. You have the threat of a gubernatorial veto and having to possibly override that. All of these are safeguards that are built into the legislative process in order to at least filter out or at least temper issues like self-serving legislation that's detrimental to the public interest, for discriminatory motives in doing legislation. As a Florida court recognized, by contrast, none of these exist in the initiative petition process. In the initiative petition process, voters more or less operate in a vacuum. They don't have staff, they don't have legal counsel, they don't have public hearings where people testify under oath about what the purpose and the meaning and the intent behind the legislation is. There's none of that available to the voters. And so having a stricter single subject rule in the initiative petition process gives some minimal floor protection to those voters to help the informational interest, to make sure that the voters are truly informed, have an opportunity to be informed about what it is exactly that they're voting on. And also to prevent putting a voter to this Hobson's choice of having to vote on an initiative that contains multiple subjects, some of which that they support and some of which they do not.
What about the argument Mr. Waters made that the time limits here on the initiatives is almost impossible to go out and get those signatures and go through all the legal challenges and all within the time period allotted under the law? Do you feel that's not squared up for today, or what? Is that the federal litigation, or what's your position on that?
I think that is probably in front of the federal court, because all we're talking about here is a constitutionality of AB 81 and 224 under the single subject rule. But in any event, those are all expedited processes as well under the statute, and for good reason, because those provide protections to the proponents of the initiative in order to move this along a little bit faster. Mm-hmm. And quickly, speaking of the standing issue, particularly with AB 81, the appellant's lack standing, I'm not sure what Mr. Waters means by merging, because I think it's very clear that the all districts rule, which they complain about, which is the rule that you have to gather signatures in all of the congressional districts, that was not enacted by AB 81. It was enacted by SB 212 in the 2009 session. What AB 81 did was it extended that rule to referenda, which for some reason were left out of 212. But in this case, they're not alleging that they're running a referendum. They're only alleging that they're running an initiative. And so even if they were to prevail on striking down AB 81, they would be in exactly the same position after the court's ruling as they are today. So there's no harm as a result of AB 81 that would give them standing in this case. And with regard to standing on the third claim for declaratory relief, they lack standing there too, as Justice Pickering has pointed out. Until they fire that initiative, it's really not an initiative at all. And as this court made clear in the Beers case, the filing requirement in the Constitution requires strict adherence. And the purpose of that is so that everybody knows exactly what it is that they are going to circulate. These assurances that they're not going to change anything are hollow, because they've already tried to surreptitiously change the petition in this case by filing an errata to an exhibit, which in fact changed the tax rate that they proposed on money. So with that, we want to
Thank you,
gentlemen.
Thank you very much, Mr. Betts and Mr. Powers.
Thank you, Alan, and I'll move quickly. The constitutional rule and the statutory rule are different by legislative design, which is amply established by the legislative history of the statutory rule. When the statutory rule was introduced in 2005, it was nearly identical to the constitutional rule. But during the committee hearings, people believed that a stricter rule should apply to initiatives because of the different differences between the initiative process and the legislative process. The language was changed. The legislature specifically took language from California, which was a stricter single subject rule that they were proposing to add to the California Constitution. In the end, the California Constitution was not amended to add that language. Excuse me. But Nevada chose to add that language to its statutes. The legislature's intent was to make a strict single subject rule. And again, in 2009, a bill was introduced that changed the statutory rule back to similar language like the constitutional rule. The legislature rejected that bill in 2009. During the committee hearings in 2009, both proponents and opponents made it clear that there were differences between the two rules, and the initiative one was stricter. They're different by legislative design because the legislature has the power under the Nevada Constitution, Article 19, to adopt procedures to facilitate the initiative process. That's what they did with the statutory rule, and that's why it's different. This act, the two bills at issue here, the act relating to elections, are no different than the 1861 and 1866 acts that were the first acts relating to elections in Nevada. Those acts established the practice of combining elections-related laws into a single act, a comprehensive bill on elections. Since then, the legislature has enacted 248 pieces of legislation over the past 150 years that were an act relating to elections. These bills are no different, just simply too late in the day to change the liberal rule of construction and align it with the statutory rule, which was supposed to be different by legislative design. And finally, if this court were to change the liberal rule of construction, it would have drastic effects on the legislative process. Mr. Waters contends that these two bills should not be two bills, but they have subjects that should make them 20 bills. So what does that mean for the legislative process, where we have 1,300 bill draft requests every session? Does that mean there should be 13,000 bills? It's just impractical, it's unreasonable, and it would be an absurd interpretation of the Constitution to require the legislature to deal with that many bills during each legislative session. The single subject rule of the Constitution has worked. It stops the omnibus kitchen sink bill that Congress uses regularly, where Congress can attach anything it wants into a single bill. That's why the single subject rules are in the state constitution, to stop the omnibus bill that Congress uses to this day. The single subject has worked. A comprehensive bill on elections is not an omnibus bill. It only deals with elections. It doesn't deal with unrelated subjects.
I'd like to reserve time for my other co-counsel in the matter, and if you have any questions, I certainly feel free to
answer. Okay, thank you, Mr. Powers. Mr. Schrader.
Mr. Chief Justice. Justices, good morning, Brendan Schrader for the Nevada Mining Association et al. As intervener defendants. And I will be exceptionally brief given the ticking time and confine myself to an issue that we raised a number of times in the district court involving limitations on actions. Every civil claim, almost without exception, is subject to some manner of limitation. A window opens, the claim accrues, a window closes, the claim is foreclosed by limitations. Even constitutional claims. Now, we have to remember this is not a substantive challenge to any of these sort of statutes that the bills as vehicles disperse throughout the code. This is a challenge to a procedure, to one act by the legislature, two acts really, SB 224 and AB 81, regarding the manner of their passage and enactment. It is sprinkled through the briefs that this is somehow a facial challenge, but it isn't really. But a facial challenge in this court's jurisprudence deals with whether or not every application is invalid. This is not about the application of substantive portions of the law. It's about how the law was passed. So if you agree that a limitation must apply even to this type of action, what type of limitation are we talking about? Other states, such as Iowa and others in Mabry, adopt a codification rule. Single subject legislative claims or title challenges are foreclosed after codification within the code. Now, that rule has much to recommend it because it respects and encourages a finality of legislation and the structure and the stability in the code. It's probably not perfect for Nevada because we don't appear to have the type of codification procedures that would put everyone on notice as to the moment at which your claim is now foreclosed. So we're left with some basic statutes and limitations. And those can apply in this matter fairly straightforward. Appellants is challenging SB 224 from 2005 and AB 81 from 2011. He brought his claim in January of 2012. That is at least 6.5 years beyond enactment of SB 224 in 2005. And the legislative rule talks about enactment. And we can argue about what the precise moment of enactment is. Is it passage by the second house? Is it being signed by the governor as a process of enactment? That's really only a week's difference in June 2005 in this particular case. But as far as accrual goes, everyone's presumed to know the law. The legislative actions, conduct, meetings, hearings, all of it is available. It is published. It is online. Everyone is presumed to have access to it. It is not plausible to say I had no notice of this conduct, the passage by the legislator, until years later. Appellants do argue that there's some sort of continuing violations doctrine. I don't think that that's also plausible in this case. This is one moment in time for each of these bills. So at the very least, SB 224, the claims appellant makes regarding the legislative conduct in that matter, is foreclosed by several years by the appropriate statute of limitations, whether it's 2 years or 4 years, which is another argument within the briefs, but it doesn't matter to the results in this case.
Questions? Mr. Schrader, thank you very much. Mr. Griffin.
Morning, Your Honors. One jumps in, we're all going to jump in. So I will make this very brief. Matt Griffin, on behalf of the Nevada Resort Association, I would like to speak briefly today with you specifically about the remedies of what Mr. Waters is asking this court to do. Before I get into that, I would echo that the Resort Association, as interveners in this action, firmly believes and sees no reason for this court to depart the traditional interpretation of Article 4, Section 17 This was the interpretation at the time. The legislature enacted both of these bills that are in question. They relied on this guidance from this court on Indianationalist bills, and that these bills were not enacted in any manner different than any other bill on whatever topic that the Nevada legislature addresses. Second, I would concur with Mr. Schroeder in the statute of limitations argument that
this court should countenance a bill that is presented under the term or subject abortion, or this court should countenance a bill that enacts all manner of some statutes under the general concept of vehicles.
I think there is, and this court has found in the past, that certain legislation has gone outside of the Article 4, Section 17 analysis of a single subject. But the general rule is that if all
should we, in this case, take a look at some of the provisions in 224 and to determine whether they actually relate to elections.
And if you are,
shouldn't we make that analysis?
I think you should. And I think the answer, based upon the case law, I mean, and Mr. Powers would do that, going back to the inception of statehood, they have enacted legislation that is titled an act to elections. And so long as all of the provisions within that act are germane to that title, the public is on notice. And that people are aware that there might be legislation considered and or passed that relate to elections. And if you do that in 224, if you do that in 81, I think those answers are, and I don't even think that Mr. Waters has really argued to the court that these violate the existing rule. I think he's asking the court to, he's conceded that point, he's asking the court to adopt a new stricter rule. And what part of what I want to present to the court today is that if you are inclined to adopt a stricter rule, obviously the court has the authority to do that. There's been discussion in dissent Candelaria that that might be a more appropriate standard. But if you do that, this is not the only two pieces of legislation who would be subject to the chopping block. It would monumentally affect thousands of bills enacted by the Nevada legislature under the previous guidance of this court. I propose that if you are inclined to adopt a different standard, a stricter standard, more akin to the initiative petition single subject standard, that rule is only applied prospectively. And this issue is briefed in front of your honors. The rule in federal court is that they do not have prospective applications of new precedent issued by the court. They specifically left the issue up to state courts whether or not they want to have prospective applications of their decision. And in fact, Nevada has adopted the prospective application of decision. There's been three instances that I've determined that this court has prospectively applied the new rule, the first being Clausen v. Cummings, 86 Nevada 684, Columbia State, 119 Nevada 650, and Duke v. Duke, 98 Nevada 148. It is not uncommon to apply these prospectively. The harm that exists if these are applied retroactively, this court will be inundated with lawsuits. Nothing in the statutes will be firm. The citizens of the state will not know which laws are required and filed because they don't know how these laws were enacted. Additionally, the powers of the executive branch, the powers of the judicial, the legislative, the agencies, most of those were enacted under the existing statute or the existing interpretation of Article 4, Section 17. If that changes and it's applied retroactively, there is a great amount of risk that all these other pieces of legislation would be brought in front of the court. So with that, I know I've probably gone over time a little bit, but I would submit that I don't see a rule that intervener doesn't see a need to change it, but if you do, we would suggest and ask the court to make the harm on the public and the citizens as less severe as possible.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Griffin, very much. Mr. Waters, we'll give you another minute because this side went over, so equalize the time. Tracy, so if you'd add, we'll make it rounded off to 10 minutes for Mr. Waters on his rebuttal.
10 minutes?
10 minutes, okay. I think that evens it up about. Okay, so go ahead.
I'm going to be out of sequence here because of the multiple deals, but let me start with what Kevin said. First of all,
which Kevin? No. Good. Okay.
Right.
Mr. Benson. Okay.
The power that 224 was passed under is under Article 19 with one word, and that is facilitate. If you look under the English language, under Webster's or any dictionary in this country, English language dictionary, and you look up the word facilitate, it means to make easier. I don't think anybody would think that 224 made the amnesty process easier. I don't think they did. I don't think that's possible. Now, let me go to the issues that are raised other than that. First of all, anybody that has any experience with legislature process out there knows that to a large extent it's very opaque. Very opaque. Mm-hmm. I mean, particularly in the Conference Committees, when a bill goes in one way and comes out totally different, and have a voice vote on it, and people don't even know they voted on it. It's not near as transparent as they say. If this court were to strengthen that single subject restriction on the legislature, prospectively, I never ask it to be done retroactively. They keep saying that. And I said, no, I didn't ask for that. I know that would cause problems. But if you would strengthen that...
So you agree, Mr. Waters, that 224, as enacted in 2005, is constitutional?
Is constitutional? Mm-hmm. I do not, because I don't think it facilitates the listed process. That being the same, but I'm saying 224, I think, does violate the Constitution of the single subject restriction. That, I think, it violates. Did I answer your question?
Well, Justice, there seems to be some confusion. The counsel argue that you've conceded that the rule that's used, the liberal construction rule that's used to interpret the Constitution and its application to statutory enactments by the legislature would make 224 enforceable and constitutional. You're not conceding
that. That was not my position. My position, Your Honor, is either ask the court to apply the strict interpretation to both of them if you're going to do it, or the liberal construction to both of them. Mm-hmm. That's what I've asked the court to do. Do the same.
Okay, so Mr. Waters, well, let's say, and I have no idea what the court feels about this, because that's what we're doing the argument. But let's say the court agreed with the respondents that the liberal standard for the legislature is okay for the reasons enumerated. You would ask us then to say that the same standard should apply in our interpretation of 295.061. Is that correct?
Yes, that is one of the alternatives I've asked for. The problem is as long as that statutory standing is given anybody to come in and challenge it, they're still going to run us out of time. That's why that is such a horrible thing. I don't know of any other state that gives statutory authority to anybody that's not even being harmed by it to come in and sue and take it off the ballot.
So you're saying even if there's a more liberal standard on the single subject rule that you're going to get all the lawsuits anyway and it's going to impede gatherings?
As long as this is passed. Now go to the statute of limitation.
Of course.
Based on the statute. Either they misunderstand this or it's a red herring. First of all, this is not a money damage case. It is not a 1983 case. It is not a suit for quiet title. Those are governed by statute of limitation. This is a facial challenge. Strictly a facial challenge to the constitutionality of it. Now, if we were to apply their logic to a statute, to a facial challenge, then look where we'd be. The Jim Crow statute would still be alive in Georgia. Hypothetically, they could pass a law that says we're going to invite them to take whatever land they want, and we're going to have to pay for it, and then not enforce it for 4 years, because until they enforce it, you've got no standing. Then after 4 years, here they come, and say, wait a minute, they're over 4 years now. You can't challenge it now. That's what the implication would be if you listen to them on the statute of limitation. This is not a money damage case. Money damage cases, property involved, cases involving types of property, yes, they're barred by the statute of limitation, but not this one. This is a facial challenge.
But your challenge is that the statutes as enacted violated the single subject rule in the Constitution applied to legislation,
yes.
Correct?
Yes.
Why is that not a fait accompli at the moment of enactment? I think that's their argument, which is what would differentiate it from the Jim Crow statutes.
Because we didn't have standing, Justice Pickering. We didn't have standing. We only have standing when we prepared this initiative and ready to file it. Then we have standing. And for example, since they passed that, we only have standing from September to May of each other year. So if you take the statutory time, you need to divide that by 2.4. Because only time you can file initiative is from September to, I believe it's May the 19th of the following year, every other year. So if they're complaining 6 years, they should both divide it by...
And so far, you have not filed, is that correct?
No, that's why we're here.
That is correct, right?
Yeah, that's why we're here, because we want it vetted before we go file it by this court. Then it'll be res judicata to all of the power brokers that want to go sue us. Did I answer your question?
You did.
Thank you. Thank you, Justice.
Okay.
All right, now, let's see, other outstanding issues. I think I've covered the statute of limitation, the rightness, I think we've covered that. As I said, when you look at 224 in this handout sheet, each one of these, the legislature has essentially pigeon these in separate sections, like 241 is meetings of state and local agencies, 294A is campaign practices, 295 is initiative and referendums, 306 is recall of public officers, and even the Constitution on initiative has got it listed as initiative. The point I'm making is these are all separate subjects. And if you could ever charge the legislature with violating a single subject, I think this would be it. Otherwise, you can never be. I mean, I guess there is a more extreme situations, but certainly this is more aggravated than any I've seen in the past. Now, as far as I was trying to think of anything else that they brought up. Does the court have any questions?
Questions from the justices? I had one question, Mr. Rose, if you don't mind, just a little bit of time and thinking about the single subject issue and the liberal versus strict. Let's say the legislature wanted to introduce a bill or legislate or wish to on criminal sentencing, and the sentencing law says this: we double the penalties for child sex offenders. Point one. Number two, we abolish the death penalty. And it's called criminal sentencing. How do you think, how would that play in on maybe where we're at with the Constitution, with the legislature, and maybe let's take the Congress, say that was an initiative that was being proposed. Is that something that violates the single subject rule either way or not? What would your thoughts be on that?
If you're taking two separate crimes and putting them in the same statute, I think they could get away with that.
Okay. How about as an initiative, if that were proposed, then?
Well, in my opinion, Justice Gibbons, it's one thing to have a statutory single subject restriction on a statutory change, but to have it on the Constitution, that means you would lock the Constitution down. Mm-hmm. I don't think that should ever be allowed by the legislature.
Okay.
That's a totally different thing.
And that's your facilitate argument?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes.
So?
Sure, there'll be a thousand other things you want to ask me, but I ask the court to, I know this sounds like a cliche, but I would like the court to come down on the side of history, because I believe history would be on our side in this matter, because, you know, we're fighting democracy all over the world, and I don't want it allowed to be shepherded here.
Well, I think we make legal history every day, maybe in our decisions.
We only deal with things that are brought to this court. Unlike the governor, the attorney general can go out and find problems. You have to bring problems that are only brought to you in very narrow circumstances.
Right.
Thank you
very much. Okay, thank you all. Again, thank you for splitting your time. I'm getting that organized for both sides, and we appreciate all the excellent briefs and oral arguments, and we'll take this case under submission.